Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello everyone and welcome back to These Times. I'm Tom McTague.
And I'm Helen Thompson.
This week we were going to talk about something else entirely, but of course we're turning back to the Middle East once again after the extraordinary events of Saturday night when Iran launched its first ever attack directly on Israel, with an unprecedented armada of drones, cruise and ballistic missiles, half of which seemed to fail on launch, and almost all of the rest were then shot down by a quite startling coalition of states, including the United States, Britain, France, Jordan, and potentially even Saudi Arabia. In its wake, we have a situation of extreme tension and danger, with the war in Gaza grinding on and Joe Biden now deep into an election year, which will shape the future of the world for decades to come.
Obviously, there's quite a lot of different angles from which we could discuss this. And I think we're both very aware of the level of uncertainty around what would come next or what might come next. So for this week anyway, because I'm sure we're going to be returning to this in weeks to come, we've given ourselves this question to try to answer, which is, how does the Middle East now look to the Biden administration after the United States has, for the first time in its history, had to take direct military action in defense of Israel?
Iran has started a direct attack on Israel by launching dozens of drones to attack targets there. Israel says its armed forces are on full alert with combat planes in the air. Iran has said it wants revenge for a suspected Israeli attack almost 2 weeks ago on its consulate in Damascus.
Israel Defense Forces saying that 99% of them were taken out of the sky.
And it would not have happened if we were in office. You know that. They know that. Everybody knows that. But America prays for Israel. We send our absolute support to everyone in harm's way. This is an attack that would not have happened.
President Biden tonight urging restraint as concern grows among senior officials that the U.S. could be dragged into a broader conflict in the Middle East, depending on how Israel responds to Iran's attack.
We are ready for any threat that will come to Israel. We will do everything we need, everything, to defend the state of Israel.
So, Helen, the first thing to say is we're recording this at 9 a.m. on Monday morning, and this is obviously an incredibly fast-moving situation, which could develop before we've even stopped speaking, let alone by the time people are listening to this. So I suppose what we wanted to do, as you said at the beginning, was to look at the difficulties facing the Biden administration in particular as it heads towards this election in November, what choices it has dealing with both Israel on the one hand and Iran on the other. And a question that kind of lies behind that, which is what this attack says about American power more generally. So what we're going to try to do is deal with Israel in the first half and Iran in the second, but it's impossible, really, to disentangle the two states entirely. So, I mean, in one sense, this seems like a success for the Biden administration, in that it, you know, it led a coalition that shot down almost all of these missiles. But I suppose what we should try and do is go back to the beginning of the Biden administration's approach. How has it got itself into this situation where it seems to have been able to assemble a coalition to defend Israel, directly defending Israel, that includes some of these key Arab actors? This is quite an extraordinary moment just in that regard, in that it was so successful and it was working alongside Jordan and, it seems anyway, Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I think if we go back to the beginning, Tom, of the Biden administration, as you've just suggested, we can see the context in which this coordinated action has happened, emerged, and that is around the Abraham Accords. Now, the Abraham Accords, as we've talked about, I think, on a number of occasions now, were the agreements pursued or encouraged, perhaps would be a better way of describing it, by the Trump administration to push for the normalization of relations between Israel and a number of Arab states led by Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, so not states that were involved in this action. And it's pretty clear, again, if you look prior to the 7th of October of last year, that the way that the Biden administration was thinking about Israel and Israel's security was through that lens. And what, in some sense, the Abraham Accords opened up. And I think it's really significant to concentrate on a moment right at the beginning of the Biden presidency, January 2021. This was actually a decision in itself that was made by the Trump administration, but was implemented by the Biden administration when it first came in. And that was to move Israel from European command in the American military structure to Central Command. Now, we've talked about Central Command a few times before. Central Command was created in the wake of the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan and the Iranian Revolution in 1979. It's always posed some difficulties for the Americans because there was no Arab state that was willing to host it. So it's the military headquarters of Central Command has been in Florida. It's also true that until this moment, Israel was not in Central Command. And that was in deference to the sensitivities of a number of Arab states with whom, well, of the Arab states with whom America had some kind of like military relationship. So what's crucial is that the Abraham Accords create a context in which Israel could be put into essentially the US-led regional military command structure. And that has meant that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, has taken part in yearly war games with an emphasis on aerial defence. There's been intensification of US-Israeli joint military exercises since then. And if you say, well, what's the geopolitical logic of that? It's clearly that the United States, Israel, and these Arab states, including obviously Saudi Arabia, have got an antagonist, and the antagonist is Iran.
Yeah, it's fascinating, I think, to think back into that sort of late Trump administration period and some of the decisions that he has taken that were then accepted in effect by the Biden administration. Now, we can pull that camera back a bit further and say there are other things that Trump did that Biden has taken on, which we've talked about economically in terms of global trade, its relationship with China, those kind of things. So we're still shaped very much by that first Trump administration. It wasn't just this sort of chaotic madman in the White House who left just a trail of destruction. He's actually created things that have lasted. And I think in the Middle East, we can see this. So I think there are a number of different moves that he made that play into the importance of the Abraham Accords. So he moved the American embassy. That was a decision sort of, I think a lot of these ideas are about sort of ripping off the plaster of something that didn't any longer make sense and just doing it and accepting the blowback. Or daring the blowback to come. So there's moving the embassy. There was junking the Iranian nuclear deal,
which we'll come to in the second half.
Yeah, and then there's the Abraham Accords. And I think the logic behind the Abraham Accords, this is what I was speaking to somebody in the British government about this, and they were saying that they were very difficult for diplomats to accept because they were often led by Jared Kushner with no diplomatic experience, and he often took businessmen with him to try and negotiate these deals. And they were about, effectively, let's just park the Palestinian question and just try to do deals anyway. And that was the reverse of what had happened before, which was, if you go back to, say, to Tony Blair's logic, it was, we need to deal with the Palestinian question in order to then achieve Middle East. Well, this is the reverse of that. Let's deal with normalizing relations between Israel and Arab partners, and then we can get to the Palestinian question. And the key goal of this was the normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. And if you could do that, it was a complete game changer. And one of the driving factors of that, of course, was that both of them saw Iran as its principal regional rival. And in fact, over the weekend, we've seen reports that the Saudis admitted that, or have claimed that October 7th was a direct attempt by Iran to stop the Abraham Accords, the normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. So all of this is clearly connected. And it just, I do think it's so striking to think about the Biden administration implementing Trump policies.
I think that it is, but I think that it's really also really striking that they come late to the Saudi issue in that it's, we'll keep the Abraham Accords with the states that are already in, which have extended beyond those first two by that point. But I don't think that there's an initial move in the direction of bringing Saudi Arabia in from the Biden administration. I think that that's what Trump would have absolutely have liked. But if you go back to the things that Biden was saying during the campaign, so the 2020 US presidential election campaign, he was basically saying he was going to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah state.
Yeah.
And the emphasis, and we'll get to this in the second half, and this is why it's been difficult to keep them apart, was on resurrecting the Iran nuclear deal. And that, as far as Biden administration was concerned, it wasn't going to support the Saudis in Yemen. And for all the kind of more complicated rhetoric that the Obama administration had engaged in about the Yemen issue, it had never not backed in the end Saudis over that issue. There's a change, I think, on the Saudi front for two reasons. The first of them comes in the summer of 2021, when the Biden administration realizes that oil prices are rising and that it's going to be quite difficult to do much about it without having the Saudis on side and through their OPEC plus. But the real push, I think, from the Biden administration to bring Saudi Arabia into the Abraham Accords comes actually in the six-month period before the 7th of October in 2023. And it comes when it looks like the Chinese are bringing about Saudi-Iranian rapprochement.
Right.
Maybe Russia's involved in that too, that it's not so straightforwardly it's China. But I think that is a bit of a shock in Washington. And it's from that point on that you see the big push for normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel, and that coming from within the Biden administration. And then the 7th of October happens, and that's why you can get, as you've just quoted, Tom, the Saudis now saying that they see Hamas's attack on the 7th of October as being driven by Iran's desire to disrupt that.
Yeah, and I think one of the striking things that we can see from October the 7th to today is how little, in a way, response there has been from those Arab states like Saudi Arabia, which were hoping to normalize relations with Israel. There just hasn't been this enormous blowback. There might have been among public opinion, but I think from the governments, what you've seen is you've had 6 months of extraordinarily brutal war, and then you've had an attack on Israel, and Saudi Arabia and Jordan have shot down those missiles aimed at Israel. They have defended Israel as part of a Western coalition. That is a big moment. And I suppose in one sense, then, we can see the American relationship with Israel as strong as ever, as important as ever. You've got murals, I think, going up over the weekend of Biden in as a Superman in Jerusalem. And that changes something about that, the nature of that relationship, because you don't have to go back very far to think about the incredibly tense relationship between Netanyahu and Obama, when Netanyahu was effectively placing all these cards on Trump. And now you have a relationship between a Democratic president and an Israeli administration that is, when it has been tested, has been shown to be incredibly strong. Biden, I think, instincts are stronger towards Israel than Obama's.
I think that's that really is true. I think if you look at the moment after the 7th of October, the first response of the Biden administration was to move two aircraft carriers.
Yes,
One into the Persian Gulf, I think, and one into the Mediterranean. And basically, the point of those moves was to say to Iran, they are there to deter you, and perhaps to Hezbollah as well. I think, though, it's also the case that prior to this weekend, and this is where I think that Biden's choices are still really quite complicated, is that it had become domestically, politically harder for the Biden administration to support Israel unequivocally. And that you could see growing, not just behind-the-scenes tensions, but overt tension over this. You could see it in the fury in Israel at the vote at the United Nations that the Biden administration didn't veto. And you could see it in the Biden administration letting it be known, really, I think, quite like openly, that it was unhappy about quite a number of the ways in which Israel is prosecuting the war against, not only against Hamas, but against the Iranian Revolutionary Guard too, because the context, obviously, in which Iran took this action, or the immediate context, perhaps we should say, in which Iran took this action, was the Israeli action against an Iranian consulate in Syria, that the Biden administration's brief that it did not get sufficient notice for, and was very unhappy about what the likely consequences of that were going to be. And underneath all that is the fury in part of the Democratic Party, the progressive part of the Democratic Party, about the Biden administration's, as they see it, unequivocal support for Israel. So in this sense, I think that what we've seen during the last 6 months or so is that the political consensus, and interestingly, this isn't just actually on the left, but on parts, at least, of the right too, in America, has fractured.
Mm.
And yet we've now reached this moment, as it has fractured, in which for the first time the United States has had to take direct military action to defend Israel.
Yeah, I think if you were an optimist in Israel, you would look at this and you would say, okay, let's just apply Occam's razor to what has just happened and to see what it's revealed. And what it has revealed is that Israeli military power combined with Western military power led by the United States and its allies in the Gulf and then the UK and France is still an incredibly formidable weapon that it has at its back, and that it has worked. When it was tested, it worked. Everything that they've been preparing for was deployed successfully. And yet, as you say, I think there's a kind of fragility under this. In one sense, the Biden administration is playing a traditional role here. It has to display its own strength. Biden is very well aware of American presidents, particularly Democratic presidents, who have shown weakness in regards to the Middle East and then lost. Jimmy Carter is an obvious example. It has to do two other things, though. It has to support Israel, show it that it's got its back, as it has done. It has to allow Israel to defend itself, and to do that, Israel needs to hit those that have attacked it. So it needs to be able to punish Iran, punish Hezbollah, punish Hamas whenever Israel is attacked. That is a core part of Israeli military doctrine. But also, the Biden administration is playing that role that as often American administrations have to play, which is to restrain Israel in its actions after being hit. And it's restraining Israel because of its own domestic politics, but also because of the wider geopolitics that it has to think about. It has to think about oil prices. It has to think about the balance in the Middle East. It has to think about all of these much bigger questions while Israel is focused entirely correctly on its own national defense. And so this is a role that we saw playing out in the first Gulf War, where Israel was hit by weapons from Iraq, but didn't respond under pressure from the Americans, who were fighting Saddam at that moment. So there is a precedent for an American president leaning hard on Israel to stop a response. And this is something that we are already seeing play out, according to reports. Biden is saying to the Israelis, take the win. And the Israelis are replying, we haven't won because somebody has tried to attack us with 300 missiles of various descriptions. So this is one of the games playing out. But I think what has changed, Helen, is what you were saying there about the domestic politics here. I think that one of the big changes is surely that on the right, there seems to be some fracturing of support for Israel. So we've already seen it on the left, and that has been a part of the story that Israel has had to deal with for a while. And it's potentially, it's one of the reasons why Netanyahu backed Trump so vociferously in the run-up to his election in 2016. But in this case, there was a rally over the weekend where Trump was criticizing Biden for being weak, and the crowd were shouting, Genocide Joe. You know, this is something totally new, and you've got influential commentators, podcasters like Joe Rogan or Tucker Carlson being very critical of Israel. So something is happening within American domestic politics that is a real problem for Israel, because one of the things that these events over the weekend showed was not just Israeli military strength, but its dependence on an international coalition, its total dependence. It couldn't have done this alone.
I think that you're right in the sense that this criticism, fierce criticism of Israel that's coming from the right, looks like it could be quite politically consequential. And if you think that Israel has basically worked to maintain domestic support in the United States for Israel through Congress, and that as you have much more fracturing in Congress, perhaps we should have expected much more fracturing on that. I think there is a little bit of a history to this. Like, if you go back to the late 1970s, there's a moment in which Carter is giving a longer term guarantee to Israel that the United States will, in an emergency, provide oil to it. And this is quite a big deal, because this is a point in which the United States has become the world's largest oil importer itself. And you have Barry Goldwater, the former Republican presidential candidate, being really quite critical about that. I think what is true, though, and I think this gets us in a way like nicely onto where we want to go in the second half, is that for a long time, Iran has been the organizational framing of how the Israel question is seen in terms of the US actually providing military support to Israel. Because I think there's a bit of a tendency, or there can be a bit of a tendency anyway, to think that this is just like a long continuous history. But actually, from 1948 in the creation of Israel through to 1967, France was Israel's principal military support. It becomes the United States, but it becomes the United States, I think, in a really deep sense. So the point, for instance, when Israel gets a status of major non-NATO ally in the 80s, in the context in which Iran is seen as the principal threat in the region. Now, as you said, that's complicated by the Gulf War, the first Gulf War in 1990. And it's quite interesting that I think that it's the case that the air defense that the George Bush senior administration sends to help Israel defend itself from Iraq, they don't work very well. And this is obviously a very different moment where it has basically worked. But there was a way, which maybe still does hold, of framing defending Israel as part of doing the US's own work about containing Iran. And I think in one sense, then, the question in terms of the domestic politics is there a way for that notion still to take hold? Because if you just take Trump for a moment, you can hear some sort of critical remarks from Trump on Israel. But then he gets almost like he drags his mind back into line from his freewheeling of, no, we need to be strong against Iran. And then Israel fits into that.
Yeah, his criticism of Israel, if I remember, is because it didn't support his attack on Soleimani, the Iranian general, or didn't take part in that attack. And so he felt, oh, again, it's America who's shouldering the burden here. But yeah, if you place Israel in that alongside America's other allies, Poland, Britain, Germany, France, Japan, and Trump's criticism of those allies, Trump's criticism is you let us do all the work, or you force us to do all the work and you get a free ride. Well, Israel clearly is not a free rider in this respect. It does the work. And you can actually see that in there was a tweet over the weekend by Naftali Bennett, the former prime minister of Israel, which sets that out very explicitly. In fact, he says, we're doing the West's work here. And to allow us to do that, you need to have our back. But that's both playing to the American audience and the Western audience, but is also demanding something. It's showing a weakness there, that it does rely on Western public opinion, principally American public opinion, and military support.
And I think that this is where, if we turn it back just to finish this half, to the dilemma of the Biden administration, is that the criticism that it's been dealing with from the left of the Democratic Party is about the Palestinians. Although you can say that those Republicans or Trump supporters, perhaps we should just call them at Trump's like rally, are using that language of the genocidal Joe language that originates actually on the left. I think that the impulse behind it is more straightforwardly isolationist,
yep,
and not wanting the United States to get involved in more wars,
yep,
in the Middle East. But it's pretty difficult for the Biden administration really to deal with either of those pressures, both because it can't think about retreating from the Middle East, and at the same time is that the relationship between Iran and Hamas means that actually creating any kind of political space in which it can look like it's getting closer to the Palestinian cause is now extraordinarily difficult, much harder than it was for Bill Clinton in the 1990s, where you might say that it's an interlude in the Iran story. If the Iran story really, in terms of how difficult it is for Washington, comes into focus with Iran's nuclear weapons and then with Iran becoming a more openly anti-Semitic state, at least at leadership level, I mean by that from like 2005, they're not problems that Bill Clinton's dealing with in the 1990s. But in that sense, the core of the Biden administration's dilemma is that it can't really do anything to satisfy this domestic criticism.
And on that, we should turn to what America's going to do about Iran, the other major actor in this, in the events over the weekend, after the break.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back, everyone. So we started the first half thinking about the inheritance that Joe Biden had from Donald Trump when he became president in 2021. And maybe we should start the second half with thinking in the same way and in relation to Iran in this half. And the obvious thing that he inherited is an Iranian nuclear deal that Trump had scrapped. So it had gone. Obama had built this deal with the support of Russia, Britain, France, Germany, fiercely criticized by Israel. And Trump had scrapped it. And in its place, put in a policy of maximum pressure on Iran to squeeze the Iranian regime economically as tightly as it could to get to a point where it could get a better deal from Iran, perhaps not a nuclear deal, but a much stronger position. And when we spoke to Ali Ansari during our Iran episode, I mean, he was saying that there was a fair amount of logic behind this position and that there was a reasonable criticism that the Obama administration had been too keen on getting a deal and too weak in its negotiations with Iran. But Joe Biden came in as president campaigning to resurrect the Iranian nuclear deal. And this is something that has just proved impossible to do. And now I think, I mean, one consequence, Helen, is clearly that it's gone, but I think it was clear anyway that it had gone before these events. It had gone before October the 7th. This is something that Biden was not able to do despite his campaigning. And so again, Biden is inheriting a Trump legacy that he is then implementing.
Yeah. With a caveat, I think we should get out. I think the caveat is important, but just to follow through on what you said, Tom, because I think it ties quite clearly to the position that we discussed in the first half of Biden's positioning on Saudi Arabia initially. So this is, I think, the one area where you can say that there's a really distinctive Biden critique of the Trump presidency in foreign policy terms, because obviously in domestic policy terms, there's a host. Yeah. Probably the other one is on the climate, on the Paris Accords. But on this, Biden presented Trump as being soft on Saudi Arabia and too tough on Iran. Mm-hmm. And that was particularly the second of those was dangerous. And he was going to be tough on Saudi Arabia and he was going to go back to where things had been before 2018 on Iran, which was the hope of some normalization of relations, not just between the United States and Iran, but the European Union and Iran too. And I think it's reasonable to say that actually restoring the Iran nuclear deal was perhaps the single most important thing early on that Biden administration wanted to change. Because as we've talked about, and you mentioned again today, there's continuity on China front, if not doubling down. If we then say, well, why was it the case that this was so important? I think at the heart of it is the thought that if the Biden administration was going to be, in energy terms, really focused on climate, really focused on the energy transition, then it needed oil markets to take care of themselves. And the crucial to that then was bringing Iranian oil exports that had been sanctioned since the nuclear deal came to an end in 2018 back onto the market. So if you had Iranian supply, oil markets would take care of themselves.
Why is that important? Is it just as a kind of bridging place to get to this decarbonized future?
Yeah, I think the hope is that you can, over the medium term, significantly reduce the oil consumed in the American economy. Mm-hmm. But in that short to medium term, you don't want prices going really above, much above $70 a barrel. And if you look at the last years of Trump's presidency, he spends quite a bit of time, not the pandemic part of it, but 2019, literally tweeting, Mohammed bin Salman, telling him that OPEC Plus should be producing more oil. He seemed to have a tolerance level around, I don't know, $73, $74 a barrel. I don't think there was anything that was really different in the way in which the Biden administration thought tolerable levels of oil prices were. And remember, at this point, there's also sanctions in place, quite tough sanctions in place on Venezuela. And so in that sense, there was a choice of, do you try to get sanctions off Venezuela? Do you try to get sanctions off Iran? And the Biden administration initially concentrated on getting them off Iran. It's subsequently moved to taking them off, or reducing them anyway, on Venezuela. And I think what we can see And this is where some of the criticism, I think, of the Biden administration's policy to Iran comes in to play, is that as it became clear that it wasn't going to be possible to resurrect the Iran nuclear deal, and I think that was sort of clear by maybe the autumn anyway of like 2021, but it was really clear after Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the alignment of Russia with Iran during that crisis.
Right.
Or during the war. I mean, remember the part that Russia had played in negotiating the first Iran nuclear deal, that the Biden administration's response then has been, I think, not really to enforce the sanctions too hard against Iran. So that if you actually look at the amount of oil, both that Iran's been exporting and Iran's just generally been producing, it's going up quite considerably. And that the nadir, like, is reached in the end of the Trump presidency. And then there's been a starting a gradual upturn and then a more significant upturn. It's not back to producing the 4 million plus barrels of oil a day that it was doing in 2016, but it's well above the 3 million mark again.
So it's a curious policy, to be honest, to be soft on Iran and harder on Saudi Arabia. And if you just be just a pure kind of amoral, realist take on foreign policy, that is a curious place to have arrived at, considering when you strip away much else, such as over the weekend and the attack on Israel, Saudi Arabia is a core part of this alliance that you need. And so it seems it's hard to quite grasp why that was the case, other than domestic pressure, that it was seen as an immoral war that Saudi Arabia was pursuing in Yemen, and that Saudi Arabia was a bad regime, and that some kind of hope, I guess, that if you extended an olive branch to Iran, that it would emerge into a more peaceful, less aggressive, potentially a partner, and then you could get this, you would have an oil produce exporting country brought into the world market. So I guess you can see the logic. But as you say, once you get into the world where Iran is sending cheap drones to Russia to attack Ukraine, it is continuing with its genocidal rhetoric and its supply of weapons to Hezbollah and to Hamas. It is opposed to
the Houthis,
opposed to any normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel, and has grown in influence into the one part of the Middle East which you've spent so much money and lives in Iraq. It just seems extraordinary why you would think that going softer on Iran without any chance of resurrecting the nuclear deal is sensible policy. It seems hard to understand.
I think in one sense that it is hard to understand. I think it is probably also the case that Trump, through his presidency, highly personalized the relationship with Saudi Arabia, and particularly with Mohammed bin Salman, and also tied his own business interests to like what was going on in Saudi Arabia. So in a way, it became the initial Biden administration positioning was a way of being very critical about Trump. I think it's also important to see that cuts another way too, and that is around the European Union, because the European Union, both collectively and as the individual member states of the European Union, certainly Britain, Germany and France, really tried quite hard to maintain both the nuclear deal and find ways of continuing to buy Iranian oil and gas. And they ran into the financial sanctions regime that underpinned the energy sanctions from the United States and gave up. So I think from the point of view of the European countries here is that what they saw as Trump's unilateralism in breaking the Iran nuclear deal on his own terms without any engagement with them was like pulling the United States out of the Paris Climate Accords, a symbol of everything that was wrong with the way in which Trump ran relations between the United States and European Union and individual European states. So in that sense, I think you could say if you were interested in repairing relations with the European Union after Trump's presidency, this was something to do. This was something that could be construed in that way, particularly when you were not going to be at all compromising with them over the China question.
Yeah, because in one sense, what Trump did to Britain in particular, but the other European countries as well, is he revealed that it was not really possible for us to run an independent foreign policy when it came to Iran, or in fact, in relation to China. We tried on both, but the might of the American financial system meant that we couldn't get around the sanctions on Iran. And when it came to Huawei with China, which is a separate story, but something similar played out, and we couldn't maintain an independent relationship that was different to the American policy. So I think that, I mean, that is something quite extraordinary that happened in the Trump presidency. So yes, I guess that's an interesting way of thinking, that Biden thought that ultimately this was weakening the American alliance, that and that if you could go back to the world pre-Trump, rewind the clock, and sort of everybody forgot that had happened, then that would be a good thing. But it just seems, when you look at it from today's place, that was wrong. That calculation, those calculations that Biden made, were false. He's ended up having to support the Saudis more. He's become more reliant on them. Mohammed bin Salman has not been removed. I mean, remember going back to the start of the Biden administration, there was some kind of hope, I think, that following the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, that actually, if the Americans said that he was not somebody who could be dealt with, that maybe he would be replaced as crown prince. And that clearly hasn't happened. And that the Iranian regime could be brought back into a more sensible place. That clearly hasn't happened. And the pressure on the Europeans that Trump was bringing to bear to try and get them to increase their military spending, that you could get to that through better relations. But in the end, the war in Ukraine has forced the hand of the Europeans, and they've had to change that anyway. It seems almost that world that Biden inherited in 2021 has gone. I mean, you know, if you project forward into the beginning of next year, whether it's either Biden or Trump who is president, it's just a far more brutal world where those hopes of better relations with Iran, with Russia, with many countries have completely disappeared. The choices facing America are incredibly difficult, it seems.
I think if we think about it through the lens you've just articulated, Tom, and that basically gets at this issue of the Iran-China-Russia alignment.
Yeah.
That is now significantly harder.
Mm. With North Korea added in.
Than it was at the beginning of 2021. Is that you can see, like, the way in which, for a number of different reasons, I think, that Russia's war against Ukraine really solidified that together. That isn't to say that there aren't, you know, profound tensions in the alignment, but, you know, it is there. And the thing that looked like it was possible in, let's say, the spring of 2023 was that Saudi Arabia was going to get pulled that way too, and perhaps the United Arab Emirates as well, despite the fact that the United Arab Emirates was one of the original two Abraham Accord states, that you could see growing Saudi-China rapprochement, and that in a sense is the context in which China could push for Saudi Iran rapprochement and the restoration of diplomatic relations. That, in one sense, you might say, frightened the US into action of pulling the Saudis back towards the Americans and towards Israel, and that division has now hardened as a result, not only, I think, of what's happened this weekend, but the fact that Saudi Arabia, the Saudi leadership, has actually really not been willing really to do very much at all to support the Palestinians since the 7th of October. But that's hardened the lines, but that means that the US-Iran situation is now significantly more antagonistic than it was. And that isn't just about the inability to bring about the Iran nuclear deal. And I think it is revealing that when Biden's under real pressure about the oil price issue in 2022, in the run-up to the midterm elections, when he basically has gone to Saudi Arabia, he's asked Bin Salman for OPEC Plus to produce more oil. And not only do they not really do that, they then immediately before the midterm elections actually introduce some more production cuts that you then, I think it's in October, it's either in October or November of 2022, see the move to loosen the oil sanctions on Venezuela as an alternative. And I think if we bring this back to, you know, the present moment, that this is where the Biden has got a real problem on his hands if the situation between Iran and Israel escalates. Because at the moment, it's not having any impact on oil prices. We're talking like on, as you said, Tom, on Monday morning, and the oil markets haven't really registered. In fact, I think that the main price that affects Americans, the WTI price, is actually a little bit down this morning. Obviously, if there were to be some significant transit shock in the Persian Gulf, that would be another matter. But Biden can't really afford, I think, given his domestic political position, to be heading to the election with oil prices up around $100 a barrel mark there, for the Americans about $85 a barrel at the moment.
Is that principally just because it's reflected in petrol stations, gas stations, or it basically means that the American economy will be in a worse place, or is it it's both?
I think that if you look like historically, certainly for the last 40 years or so, there's really quite a strong correlation between oil prices and the popularity or non-popularity of American presidents. And I think you can see, going back to 2022, just how much he didn't want to go into the midterm elections with rising oil prices, let alone the idea of being up for re-election under those circumstances. I think it's also important to see that from the American point of view, that the inflation of 2022, the part of it that came from energy, which is obviously was a significant part of it, was really about oil prices. In the United Kingdom and in European countries, but certainly in the United Kingdom, the hardest part of the inflationary shock was actually coming from wholesale gas prices. But the Americans are not importing gas in highly competitive liquid natural gas markets. They're doing the exporting of that. So there wasn't much of a gas price shock as part of their inflation shock in 2022. Oil was much more central on the energy side of that inflation shock in the US. So it's not just the experience at the people filling their cars up with gasoline. It's what it actually does to the inflation figure as well.
I think it's fascinating to try to think about this whole situation in terms of American strength or weakness, because going back to the start, we did, in one obvious sense, it showed American strength and it prepared for this. And as we said in the first half, it was very successful militarily here. American power is still extraordinary militarily. And yet the very fact that it happened and that Iran tried to hit Israel for the first time directly, having already seen the Houthis in Yemen trying to hit Israel and hitting Israeli ships and Western ships coming through that part of the world, that suggests that the American ability to order the Middle East is less than it was. It suggests more of a weakness than a strength, if you think about it like that. And also, as you were talking there, Helen, before, it made me think, it also revealed America's, maybe it's a naivety, but I think it's also a weakness, that America hoped that it could choose its allies in the Middle East partially based on morality questions or its perceptions of who is a good partner to be able to align with. I think Saudi Arabia was the obvious example there. Now it's in a situation where it can't make that decision. It doesn't seem to be able to do that. It just has to make a decision on raw power terms. It needs Saudi Arabia. It needs the United Arab Emirates if it is to continue projecting its power as it wants, and if it's going to be able to manage oil prices. And you've mentioned Venezuela. That's another example of a country that perhaps it's going to have a different relationship with if it's going to protect the oil price, and it's going to have to think about its own domestic economy. And thinking about the UK and the episode we did on the UK economy, I mean, baked into our own economic figures is the assumption that there won't be more shocks that will be inflationary. I mean, this is an example of clearly where there is a risk of that happening. So there is a fragility here. And once upon a time, you would think that Iran, North Korea, Russia wouldn't necessarily be such a formidable access. Aligned with China, that changes the game. But as we're seeing in Ukraine at the moment, that is not an axis to be dismissed militarily. These drones that the Iranians are able to produce that were sent towards Israel over the weekend, they are being used on the battlefront in Ukraine. They're cheap to make, by all accounts, and they're very expensive to defend against. So I think there were some calculations made over the weekend that this whole action cost $1 billion to defend Israel. And that's just a lot of money, and nothing like what the Iranians are throwing at this. So that there seems to me something very fragile about the Western power, even at the same time as it is being expressed so successfully.
I mean, I think it's very difficult to avoid the conclusion that American presidents cannot escape the Middle East, however hard that they try, and that they find it extraordinarily difficult to exercise power there, except in the emergency moment. So if you say, like, can the United States still keep the Persian Gulf open? I think the answer is yes, it can. Mm-hmm. And it's helped in that respect by the fact that for Iran to close the Strait of Hormuz, for instance, would be extraordinarily difficult. If you just look at the geography of the transit of the ships through the Strait of Hormuz, they're on the Oman side of it rather than on the Iran side of it. Can the United States provide air defense for Israel when it's directly attacked by Yemen and by Iran and the Houthi-controlled Yemen? Yes, it can. But what does it do next? In terms of anything other than muddling through the succession of crises that it faces, and that things just regularly turn out differently than that they, being the American presidents, hope that they would. I mean, if you just take the Yemen, for instance, you know, the Biden administration made a clear decision that it was not going to support the Saudis and its Arab allies in Yemen in the way in which the Obama administration, despite a reasonable amount of criticism at times from the Obama administration about what the Saudis were doing, actually did. And as we talked about when we did the episode on the Red Sea, the effect of the Biden administration's policies there, whatever the rights and wrongs of it, mean that the Houthis control a significant part of the territory of Yemen, and that they are able, as we've talked about, to inflict damage in the Red Sea, and now, albeit that these weapons were shot down, attacked Israel. I think that if you'd said to Biden administration officials at the beginning of this presidency that would be one of the consequences of not backing Saudi Arabia, they might be a bit taken aback.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that's what that they intended, this outcome, in terms of the decisions that they made there. And again, I'm not making any particular criticism of rights or wrongs of them in that respect. Then that might have been good, given the civilian casualties of the war in Yemen, might be reasonable reasons. for that. But it does mean that even just that part of the Middle East is in a geopolitically different place than the one that they imagined that they were dealing with.
Yeah. I mean, you were laying out the challenges there, Helen. I mean, in another sense, can it stop Russia from taking over the whole of Ukraine? Can America stop Russia taking the whole of Ukraine with arms support to Ukraine? Yes, it can, to start with. Can it defend Israel from attack from Iran? Yes. Can it defend Taiwan at the moment? Yes. Can it do all three at the same time? Very hard to know. Can it maintain that in the long term? Can it maintain its support for Ukraine in the long term, even now? That looks open to question in terms of the politics of this playing out. With a Democratic president, we haven't got the money released for Ukraine. We're seeing a fracturing of American domestic support, it seems, for Israel. There is this sense, again, that it can maintain the status quo at the moment, but it is being challenged more repeatedly, it seems, and pushing America's power backwards a bit and making it harder to do those other things that we maybe thought it could do before, imposing order to stop attacks from taking place to begin with. Can it deter China from acting over Taiwan? It hasn't deterred Russia from acting over Ukraine. So that there seems something big happening that is, I don't know, more tidal in a way, that it's hard to see because we're in the moment. But maybe if you pull all the way back, we may end up looking at this time that we're living in as the retreat of American power rather than its expression.
And I think that the domestic politics question is a really crucial part of that, because you just mentioned, Tom, the aid to Ukraine.
Hmm.
Well, there's also the aid to Israel.
Oh, tied in with
because
it.
They're
yeah.
tied in
yeah.
to it. And this has gone on for 6 months.
Yeah.
Now, I think there was something that the Speaker of the House, who's not been allowing a vote on this, said over the weekend, that suggested that he wanted to try to detach Israel military aid from the Ukraine question, or at least it could be read that he was saying that. But he's taken an awful lot of different positions in regard to dealing with the headache that he's landed himself with. And as we know, because we've talked about it before, that got tied up with the border question. The really quite difficult political questions in themselves, and they're playing out in this election year. And if you were looking at it from the point of view of the revisionist powers, and you were seeing the domestic political conflicts and the fact that it's quite difficult to follow, if you just try and follow the question of the aid and what's happening in the congressional politics lying around that, what issues getting bound up with it, what issues getting removed from it, that doesn't convey clarity of purpose, to put it mildly.
It feels like reading a Tom Holland book on Rome and the sort of how the civil war in the imperial power starts to sort of spread outwards. And because you were talking about commercial interests of the Trump family in Saudi Arabia and how that has a rebound effect on how the Democrats act in terms of the Middle East. But also, of course, the impeachment was based on ideas of corruption to do with Ukraine. So it does very much feel like while all that's going on, you've got this battle for power in the United States that doesn't seem quite as ordered as it once did, even at the same time as its economy is ridiculously strong and technologically dominant. I mean, one person put this to me, I don't know whether this is true, but it's a sort of thought experiment, that again, it is a bit Roman, in that the winner of the Civil War claims the prize for a power that is not in decline, perhaps, but still by far the strongest in the world.
Yeah, I think that the question about whether it's got technological competitors is actually quite complicated, because you could actually argue that China is in a number of respects technologically competing. I think the area where you can say that the United States has got power outside the military sphere is in energy terms in relation to Europe, and in financial terms in terms of its ability to use these financial sanctions. But what we can see on that is that if there are complicating either geopolitical factors or domestic political factors, then actually the willingness to sustain those financial sanctions against the revisionist states, in this case like Iran, can be really quite strongly lacking. And I think that if we just think about this in terms of like where Biden goes now, that he has, among other things, like to defend himself in domestic politics from the criticism that he has actually facilitated Iran's financial wherewithal in order to do this.
Yeah, through the weaknesses that we talked about at the start of this this half. I mean, on that, we've run out of time again, but hopefully we've given people a sense of some of the big questions that lie behind the attack that happened over the weekend, and I'm sure we're going to have to deal with it over the weeks and months to come. And with that, thanks very much for listening, and see you next time. This episode, as ever, was produced by Ewan Daughtry.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.